problem is with our nations today. In Isaiah 14, verse 12, talking about Satan the devil, it says, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations?" God is the one that has established national identities, national strengths, and national qualities or racial qualities. Someone mentioned to me during the week that someone here had said, "Oh, you know, Rod King's a racist." Well, I tell you what, if you think I'm a racist, I can tell you I am by the true definition of the word. I believe that God blesses the nations and the peoples and the races of this world because he loves every one of them. And he has certain strengths and qualities that he wants to see those nations and those races exemplify. It is Satan the devil who has weakened the nations by taking what should be strengths and turning them into weaknesses. I long for the day. You know, if there's one job I would like to have in the world tomorrow, it would be working with the different peoples and races and nations. I don't know if God can add that to my curriculum vitae, but I tell you what, if you're listening, God, I'd like to be involved in that. I really would, because God is, he loves the variety of nations. So let's get back to the story to understand that Ishmael's 12 sons have been very important in the fulfillment of world history. Now we want to come to another one of the great peoples of the world in Genesis chapter 27. In Genesis chapter 27. Now the identity of these peoples is not quite as clear as the Jordanians or the Arabs. And this has to do with the peoples of Edom or Esau. In Genesis chapter 27 verse 34, we're breaking into the story where Jacob has received the blessings of both the birthright and the blessings of the birthright. And here we have Esau coming in after having sold his birthright for a bowl of porridge, or pottage, or whatever that's called there, or soup. Here in verse 34, it says, "And when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry, and said unto his father, Bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, Your brother came with subtlety, and has taken away your blessing. And he said, Is not he rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. And he said, Have you not reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac answered unto Esau, Behold, I have made him your lord, and for all his brethren have I given to him for servants, and with corn and wine have I sustained him. And what shall I do now unto you, my son? And Esau said unto his father, Have you but one blessing, my father?" Now let's remember what we started with in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. The blessings of Abraham. Here, Isaac is in a position to pass on some of that blessing. And so, verse 39, "Isaac his father answered and said unto him, Behold, your dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. And by your sword shall you live. And you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass when you shall have the dominion that you shall break his yoke from off your neck." Let's go to Genesis chapter 36 and see what happened to the descendants of Esau. In Genesis 36 verse 1. Now these are the generations of Esau, who was Edom. Now remember, of course, that Esau had gone out and married Canaanite women just to spite his father and his mother. And so it lists all of his wives. In verse 6 it says, "And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house, his cattle and all his beasts and his substance which he had got in the land of Canaan, and he went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob, for their riches were more than they might dwell together." So very similar to Lot and Abraham. "And the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir." Esau is Edom. Now where's Mount Seir? Well, it's just south off this map, probably about 100 kilometers. So if we go across to this map, you'll be able to see, just south of the Dead Sea, is a green region here, which is a mountain range. And it's in this mountain range that Mount Seir, or it became known later as Salah, or Petra, is where the peoples of Edom fact, over here, on the very south, it's got Edom or Idumea. Idumea, of course, was the Latin name given by the Romans to this southern region of the South Sea, of the Dead Sea. What's interesting is that this mountain range you see running down here is actually on the eastern side of the Negev Desert. And when you go to this part of the world, you are amazed as you travel along from the Dead Sea down to Eilat, which is the very tip of the Red Sea here, this northern, on this right-hand fork of the Red Sea. As you drive along, you can see this mountain range all the way along, rising up about 3,000 or 4,000 feet, and some places even higher. Now that mountain range that runs along there forms the separation of the Great Rift. The Great Rift is a geological formation that runs from right up here at Mount Hermon, right down through the Sea of Galilee, through the Dead Sea, right down through the Negev. This actual tongue of the Red Sea is the flooded valley of the Great Rift. The Great Rift then comes on down here into eastern Egypt, right the way down through Ethiopia, until you finally get down to Lake Victoria in Uganda. It's one of the great geological rifts of the world. And what's going to happen at the return of Jesus Christ, the great earthquake that will come at that time will probably rend away the African continent from the Asian continent. And that will be the separating that will take place. It's geologically, if anyone's really interested in tectonic plates and the like, the Great Rift is one of the most interesting studies that you can do. That's a little aside. It's just that if anyone thinks they're going to be in Petra, they need to be realizing that that's right on the edge of one of the great earthquake belts of the world. Okay. Now, what happened to the Edomites? Well, they were there for quite a period of time in Petra. And then, around about 300 BC, they were displaced by a new group of people called the Nabataeans. Where did the Edomites go? Well, there's no historical record as to where they went. But the book of Obadiah gives something of a hint. And that's all it is. Last Wednesday, we went through the book of Obadiah in our midweek Bible study. And in verse 8 of Obadiah, you come across an interesting hint, as I say, as to the identity of the Edomites in modern-day terms. First of all, before we get to verse 8 of Obadiah, notice verse 21 for the time setting of this prophecy. It says, "And saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's." So we know that the time setting for the book of Obadiah is end time. You'll notice in other places. In verse 11, here's a prophecy. It says, "In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." Now the indications are, from verse 8, that the modern day nation of Turkey, could well be the descendants of Edom and Esau. Remembering, of course, that God said to Abraham that in the last days his people would be great nations. We've seen the Arab peoples. We know that the peoples of America and Britain and northwestern Europe, descended from Abraham, have also been great recipients of the great blessings of Abraham. Well, here's a possibility in verse 8. "Shall I not in that day, says the Lord, even destroy the wise men out of Zion and understanding out of the Mount of Esau? And your mighty men, O Teman." Now Teman was a city of Esau, of Edom. The speculation is that this name Teman was carried into the name of the Ottoman Empire, which was the name of the Turkish Empire that was built up, first of all, by Suleiman the Great. Now the peoples of Turkey have been a very important place for the protection of the descendants of Isaac and Jacob. For example, in 1492, when Philip II of Spain banished all Jews and Muslims from Spain, many of the Sephardic Jews of the time found shelter. So here's 1492, here's Cadiz, the one of the major cities of Spain. Philip II of Spain, living in Madrid, told every Muslim and every Jew, and they were all Sephardic Jews, they were not Ashkenazi, to leave Cadiz and to get out of Spain. He gave them 12 months to get out. Many of them went straight across here into Morocco and settled south of Rabat, south of Marrakesh, in a Jewish enclave. Another group of Jews established themselves, well, several of them established themselves in some of the cities of North Africa, but a great number of Jews ended up here on the west coast of Turkey, where Suleiman the Great's father, Selim the First, welcomed them and had let them establish themselves, and they were responsible, or partly responsible, for an incredible increase of wealth in the time of Suleiman the Great, or Suleiman the Magnificent, from about 1520 for about a 100-year period. So much so that the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, grew to its great power and prestige during the 16th century. They also contributed to the growth of the empire so that at the time of Suleiman, his empire, this is really interesting, this was a great period of time, his power extended to the gates of Vienna. In fact, we've got John Kleszynski here, who will tell you about John, is it Sobieski? Sobieski, that's the man, who came down from Poland to save the people of Vienna from the Muslims who were coming at that time. These were the Muslims of Suleiman the Magnificent. He also extended his power out as far as Persia, so that the following cities were a part of Suleiman's empire. Hungary, Budapest, Serbia, Belgrade, to Persia, to the city of Aden, down here, and of course, Algeria as well. So that was the full extent of the Turkish Empire at the time of Suleiman, and it was because he showed kindness to the Jews at that time. What I'm trying to establish here is that there is a brotherly affinity between all the descendants of Abraham. And even though there might be religious differences, there is something which binds us together. Did you know that just recently the Turks applied or made application to join the European community? They have been knocked back. They will not allow the Turks to become a part of the European community. Now, they're given all sorts of reasons, but the real reason is they're Muslim. Whereas the European community is going to become a Christian community, and not just a Christian community, a Catholic community. So they could not really allow, even though the Turks have Istanbul, which is part of European territory, they made that decision. Now this is a problem for the Turks, because their affinities are towards Europe. When Gamal Atatürk established the great Turkish system of modern Turkey at the end of the First World War, he lent very much to the Europeans. He changed his alphabet from the Arabic script, so that all of their writing is now in Latin, alphabet. He also looked very much to the United States. They are a member of NATO. The Turks have invited American air bases, so that they look that way, and as a result they do not have the full support of their brothers in the Islamic community, and they're going to have to make a choice, because the Islamic League is going to grow. Like you might say, there's a European community, an Islamic community is going to grow, and the Turks are going to have to make a decision as to which way they go. This might surprise you, but there have been some military exercises taking place in the last few months between two Mideastern countries, Turkey and Israel. Now that is really quite amazing, that here a Muslim country should be conducting military exercises with the arch enemy of the of the Islamic people, the Jews. But you see, there's something about these people. We have an affinity. You know, when the Australian soldiers went and fought at Gallipoli and we fought the Turks, when the war was over, there was an affinity between the Turkish and the Australian people that still exists today. If you go back to Gallipoli and you say you're an Australian, you will not be hated. The Turks respect the Australian soldiers. There is something about the peoples of the descendants of Abraham that is very special. How this all comes together and works together, I don't know. I know that our peoples, the peoples of America, Britain and Australia, are going to be punished by God because we have turned our back on God. But the fact of the matter is, we need to make sure that we do not have some sort of, you might say, racial prejudice against other peoples. We should understand that God works with all nations, that he loves all mankind, that he does not have some sort of favoritism to the point where he excludes people. Now, he does deal with nations, and we know that, and he does punish nations. But we should be aware of the fact that he has many prophecies for us. What about Iraq? Who are they? Well, there's only one place, really, that I have been able to come across where Iraq is mentioned, and that's to be found in Genesis chapter 10. In Genesis chapter 10. This is talking about, of course, when Nimrod established Babylon, way back at the very soon after the flood. And the only real reference that can be, you might say, established is here in verse 10. Talking of Nimrod, it says, in the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So there you go, there's Babylon. Okay. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech, from which we get the name Iraq. I can't find any other reference. Now, whether Saddam Hussein could be one of the leaders of one of the 12 tribes of Ishmael, that's about the only thing I could think of that could fit in there. But certainly, we're looking at a period of time now where America is getting herself into, I think, a very different situation to the Gulf War of 1991. I think America is a different place to when George Bush was president. And I am quite concerned about what could come out of this present conflict. And the fact that the Australian government has given their support means that we could be getting ourselves into a very difficult position. You see, world events are approaching an exponential development. What I find interesting is that in every area that we as a people, the people of God, have understood in prophecy, in church, what's happening in the church, what's happening in our own personal lives is very much exponential. Let me explain what I mean. We have observed and we have heard Mr. Armstrong and the church preach for years and years and years about the rising European community. And you might say that it's gradually developed, almost imperceptible. But now you're starting to see it rise. And when something grows exponentially, it just takes off. And what took a long time to develop, much like the population of the earth, you know, you've seen graphs of that, of course. So we can see as that growth takes place, it will really accelerate geometrically, not arithmetically. You will also notice what is happening in the church is very much parallel to world events. For years, the church went along with the same doctrine, the same practices, everything was the same. Very little, a few humps and bumps along the way. But basically, it moved along. Now, I think you'd all have to agree, you can see events in the church are taking a real move up quickly into a direction that we're going to have to trust in Jesus Christ to lead us. Now, what about our own personal lives? I've been in the church 30 years. Likewise, my life has gone along pretty generally, slowly, humps and bumps along the way. Now I know that I am in a time when things are happening in the world and in the church. And I have got to be concerned, yes, about many of you as I'm your pastor, but I tell you what, I've got to make sure that Rod King is doing his part to draw close to God, to be an overcomer. You know, too often we get distracted by other people and what things are happening with other people. God says, you leave other people to me, you take care of yourself. I think if we take care of our own spiritual overcoming and growth, we will be ready for the things that I've talked about here. We will be in a position that we will recognize where God is taking his church. Where's God taking the church at the moment? I don't know fully. It's not my job. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. All I know I've got to do is take care of this bloke. I've got to make sure that I'm doing my part in prayer and study, in overcoming and growing, taking care of the sins that are my sins, taking care of those responsibilities that are between me and God. And if I do that, and if you do it, then we will be ready, because the bride does make herself ready. So these things that I've shown you today are only symptomatic of God working his great plan of salvation, which he began with the promises to Abraham, not just to Isaac and Jacob and the 12 tribes of Israel, but to all the peoples who were descended from Abraham. Now I was going to take some time to go through the Philistines, the Palestinians. I was going to take some time to go through other nations. But I don't have the time to do that. What I do want to show you, though, is that our peoples are going to go into captivity. I'm going to show you here in Leviticus chapter 26. The train of events. Remember, I've talked about an exponential growth in prophecy being fulfilled. There are many scriptures that say, a short work will the Lord do on the earth. And it says in Isaiah 30 that the prophetic fulfillment of things will swirl behind a great dam wall until it builds up and the dam wall bursts and breaks forth. Let me tell you, when all these events that we have known about and have heard prophesied about, they will not happen gradually. They will happen quickly, so that we will be astounded at how quickly they come. Leviticus chapter 26. I went to Genesis. Been in Genesis such a lot, I thought that's where we were all the time. Verse 15. Leviticus chapter 26, verse 15. He says, and if you shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhor my judgment, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that you break my covenant, I also will do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror. The very first thing that God mentions will be a curse on Israel for not obeying his law is terror. We even have a word for it. Terrorism. We're always worried about terrorists bombing the World Trade Center. I can tell you what, we had better be a little concerned about the fact that John Howard made a decision this last week to back the United States. We have declared war on the Arab peoples. And we can expect to have retaliation. We can expect maybe our cities to be bombed and terror to come upon us. Consumption and the burning ague that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemy shall eat it. And I will set my face against you, God says, and you shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you. There is no doubt that there is a growing antipathy in this world toward the English-speaking peoples. If any of you have heard Mahathir of Malaysia, he is really crooked on the IMF for the fact that they have led the Asian economies, in their mind, along a merry dance, and then all of a sudden turned around and just cut them off. Many people in Indonesia are upset with the IMF. Let me ask you, who is the director of the IMF? Do any of you know? He's an Australian. James Wolfenden. Who was the director of the UN inspection team in Iraq? William Butler, an Australian. Not very popular at the moment. These are not Americans. These are Australians that are disliked. We're in interesting times. You're going to see more and more of an antipathy against the English-speaking peoples. Verse 17, I will set my face against you. You shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when none pursues you. You know what the Americans want to do with this Iraq war that's on? They want to make it clean. They don't want any body bags. They don't want any dead Americans. I'll make sure that this is a strategic strike against the Iraqis, and the whole thing is sanitized. Cruise missiles, all the rest, no dead Americans. And we don't want any dead Australians either. It's not just the Americans. I will, notice this, and if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins, and I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass, and your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits. And if you walk contrary unto me, and will not hearken unto me, I will bring seven times more plagues upon you according to your sins. And as you go through Leviticus 26, it gets worse and worse, until you finally come to verses 42 to 45. Then will I... verse 40. Now, we even need to go a bit before that, because that's the pleasant part. Verse 32 is what I want to read. And I will bring the land into desolation, and your enemies which dwell therein, that is, your enemies within your land, shall be astonished at it. And I will scatter you among the heathen, and will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste. Now, verse 40. If they, that is Israel, shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers with their trespass, which they trespassed against me, and that they also have walked contrary to me, and that I also have walked contrary to them, verse 42 now, then will I remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land. And the land shall be left of them, and shall enjoy her Sabbaths while she lies desolate without them. Verse 44, and yet for all that, when they be in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, neither will I abhor them, to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will, for their sakes, remember the covenant of their ancestors, that's of Abraham, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the heathen, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. These are the statutes and the judgments and laws which the Lord made between him and the children of Israel in Mount Sinai by the hand of Moses. So we're going to see the final fulfillment, the real fulfillment of the blessings to Abraham fulfilled when Jesus Christ returns and establishes the government of God in this city, Jerusalem. And he's going to bring a people who have been trained ahead of time to assist him, who understand the plan of salvation, who understand and have listened to a sermon like this, and will have a love for all people, who will be able to go out into the terrorized peoples of Arabia, of Egypt, of North Africa, of Asia Minor and Turkey, who will go to Iraq, to Baghdad, as spirit beings and say, I know you don't really trust us, but let me tell you, we're here to help you. You and I, to teach these people the way of God. We, of all people, have been given a most blessed and wonderful blessing, the truth of God, and an understanding of prophecy. I hope this afternoon you understand that God loves all mankind, that the blessings of Abraham are not just to Isaac, to Jacob, and the 12 tribes of Israel, but they also will be to the other descendants of Abraham.